Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio today on Medical Monday is one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Mark Pettis, Chief of Medicine at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He's Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and the former Medical Director of the Kripalu Institute for Integrated Healing, located in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Pettis is the author of two books, The Savvy Patient, The Ultimate Advocate for Quality Healthcare, and It's All in Your Head, Change Your Mind, Change Your Health. Dr. Pettis, welcome back to the program. To be part of today's conversation, everybody, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Mark Pettis, what's hot?
Always good to be with you, Alan. A lot of hot stuff out there these days, particularly with a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at the Mediterranean diet.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And anytime a diet study gets to the New England Journal of Medicine, it's going to open some eyes. And not surprisingly, there were huge reductions in risk of mortality, stroke, heart disease. This was a study from Spain. And as we often talk about on the show, food is medicine. And when the choice of that medicine is healthy, it makes huge differences.
So the two places we know with the lowest heart disease that I remember are Okinawa, which is a Mediterranean diet, and Crete.
Yes.
And so we've known this for a long time. But as you say, when it hits the New England Journal of Medicine, you know, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, well, I had to chuckle because as this news was breaking, it was breaking as if it were a novel, new, recent insight, when in fact, as you suggest, we've known for years that people who subside on whole, unprocessed foods live long and they live well.
And in fact, you take a look at the Framingham study and the others, we know that when you have a particular kind of diet, you do better. You know, I'm just reading a biography of Winston Churchill now, huge thing by Manchester. You know that people's health got better during the Blitz, because they couldn't get any meat, and the rest of it's amazing.
It is amazing,
just astounding.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Brooks in Rock Hill, New York. Okay, Brooks, you're on with Dr. Pettis.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi, Brooks.
I have a nephrology question, and it's quite topical because my wife is still sort of suffering the after effects. For the past 17 years, she's had a condition, and no one has been able to figure out what the condition is with the kidneys, but she'll have something that, like a surgical insult, for example, and she'll feel nausea afterwards, or most recently, she caught my son's stomach flu and felt nausea. Mm. And then when this episode happens and she begins to feel nausea, she knows she's at risk of becoming severely dehydrated. She will hydrate as much as she can, even when she's feeling nausea, but her body, she has a urine concentration issue. She seems to urinate everything out, and shows a steady deterioration where it becomes a crisis, and she has to be hospitalized and given IV fluids. And then it takes several days to stabilize her, and then they release her, but no one seems to understand the cause of this. They all say it's idiopathic, and they just don't know what's going on.
Mm. Idiopathic for our listeners should mean we don't know.
Idiopathic is
I'm an idiot, and it's pathetic.
Yeah. It feels that way, doesn't it? And there are a lot of things out there that we label idiopathic. I don't know what might be going on with your wife's kidneys, if in fact it is a kidney issue, but often a failure to adequately concentrate or hold on to salt and water at times of dehydration can occur for many reasons. Some of it can be based on potentially serious problems like what we call adrenal insufficiency, where the adrenal glands might not make enough of a hormone that would allow the kidneys to hold on to more salt and water in times of need. And often that will manifest during times of illness or trauma, you know, and I would put
so it
surgery.
Doesn't make vasopressin, right?
Excuse me?
It doesn't make vasopressin.
Vasopressin is not so much the issue there. That's more of a brain problem. But the problem is what we call mineral corticoid. which allows the kidneys to hold on to salt. And often that can be a little bit sluggish. Now, it's not a hard diagnosis. It requires some blood testing. They stimulate the adrenal glands and they check before and after. Now, this is a relatively unusual problem, but when it's been going on for years and nobody can sort of pin it, that would certainly be one often elusive diagnosis that would come to mind. And the treatment, if that were in fact the case, would be to actually replace that mineral corticoid. It's called Florinef. It's a medicine that you take once or twice a day. But there are a number of other reasons, and this having been going on for so long,
right.
I suspect many stones have been turned. Some medications can do it. Sometimes childhood illnesses can impact the kidneys later in life, and you never know what the original insult was. It may have been an infection, but the later life manifestations are the kidneys just don't concentrate or hold on to salt as well as they could.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's largely
a signal, right? The salt is supposed to send the signal to the body to hold on to fluid.
Yeah, that's correct. Once a person starts to get a little dehydrated, and our bodies are very well tuned to respond to this, the vasopressin that you mentioned in the brain will cause the urine to become more concentrated, and then this hormone in the adrenal gland will help the kidneys hold on to more salt. They work in tandem to prevent people from getting too profoundly dehydrated.
So let me get this straight. Is more salt good or bad?
Well, so there is some debate about salt. I think that if you're not dealing with high blood pressure or congestive heart failure, and maybe you have a tendency to get dehydrated, being a little more liberal with salt, more so than what we would recommend for most people, may not be a bad idea. But in general, Americans consume far too much sodium, Alan,
sure.
Probably 6 to 8-plus grams a day, when we should only be consuming about a gram and a half a
day.
Hey, Brooks, I'm so... My wife has blood pressure of a dead person, though.
Yeah.
So low.
And that can be another manifestation of adrenal insufficiency. So I would
And what's adrenal insufficiency, one more time?
It's when the adrenal glands become too sluggish in their capacity to produce more cortisol and more of this mineral corticoid, usually during times of illness or stress. And it can be a very serious problem. But again, not a hard one to diagnose with some routine blood testing.
Brooks, got to let you go. I'm so sorry. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. Let's go to Nikki in Albany, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now's the time to get in. You won't get in at the end of the program. Right now, your chances are 100%. Okay, Nikki, go.
Great. It's Mickey, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mickey.
Okay, this isn't another idiopathic question.
Right.
But what is an appropriate course of consultation for extremely high spikes in blood pressure, unpredictable, unrelated to any cardiac episodes, just happens, causing great feelings of illness?
Yeah. How high are the spikes, Mickey?
240 over 120, 220 over 100.
Yeah, so pretty impressive. And is this something that's been going on for a while? Give me a sense of the timeline.
No, I've had 3 episodes. As a matter of fact, 1 just this morning.
Hmm. And what tunes you into the high blood pressure? Are you taking it just routinely, or are you feeling having symptoms?
I'm having symptoms, so I check my blood pressure, and I watch it just go up and up and up and up.
Yeah. So,
where do I go?
Yeah, there are numerous causes, though often these do become idiopathic, that can cause these transient spikes in blood pressure. Usually, one would be looking for what we call secondary causes of high blood pressure. And those secondary causes tend to fall into a couple of categories in adults. One is a category that nephrologists or kidney specialists would...
That's you.
Someone like myself. And
yeah.
What they would be looking for specifically would be... what might be a blockage or narrowing in blood flow to one of your kidneys. So that can cause transient spikes of blood pressure. Another is sort of the opposite of what the last caller was discussing with me. The adrenal glands can sometimes put out an excess of hormone that can cause intermittent or transient spikes in blood pressure. So usually it's the nephrologist or the kidney specialist that would be the consultant to further evaluate this Depending on what one might find, if it were an adrenal problem, then that might involve more consultants like an endocrine specialist. But a nephrologist would be the best consultative next step in terms of looking at this. Now, sometimes these can turn out to be stress-mediated and things that aren't necessarily serious, but those are pretty significant spikes, and it would be good to at least exclude a secondary cause that would have some treatment.
Now, do you see private patients?
I'm not in a position right now of seeing private patients,
okay.
Mickey.
Right.
I apologize. But there are a lot of good kidney specialists in this area.
Then that's what I shall pursue.
Very good.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Mickey.
Bye. You're welcome.
Yep. And 1-800-348-2551, Joe in Stone Ridge. Joe, go ahead.
Hello, Alan.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm calling with the doctor to speak to the doctor about another blood pressure issue.
Go ahead.
Yes, Joe.
All my life I've had normal blood pressure things, 170, 180, I'm sorry, 120 over 70, 120 over 80. And that was true up to last summer. I had not had my blood pressure checked until February 11th of this year. But in the meantime, on January 31st, I had a terrible accident. My car was completely totaled. I walked away unhurt, completely unhurt. But when I went to the doctor, unrelated to that accident, when I went to the doctor a week and a half later, my blood pressure was like 160 over 95. In the meantime, I've been monitoring it every few days. It basically seems to be trending down, but I haven't gotten below 87 or 88. And I'm just wondering if that accident could still be affecting my blood pressure.
Okay, here we go, because we got to be out of here by 20 after. Go ahead.
Yeah, so hard for me to connect the accident outside of any obvious, physiologic stress response, Joe. And even though you may not reflect on the accident having not been seriously injured as a source of stress, people go into fight flight, if you will, which is a physiologic response that can cause blood pressure to run higher than it ordinarily would. And often that'll be precipitated by a, quote unquote, traumatic event. And, having been in a car accident myself and you total your car, that's pretty traumatic. And even as time moves on, just being behind the wheel might cause some subtle activation of a fight flight response that you may not perceive as stress per se, but could be significant enough to be affecting your blood pressure. It would be hard for me to connect an accident with a sort of a physical cause, a damage to your kidneys. That would have manifested very early on. It's also important to consider that some people do just have a tendency for their blood pressure to go up a little bit over time, and maybe the accident is sort of true and unrelated. And there, we're usually looking at weight and changes in diet and blood work to check your kidneys and thyroid, just to make sure that there isn't an alternative source for those elevations that you're seeing.
Yeah. Since I saw the doctor on February 11th, I have basically cut down on my sodium intake dramatically, and I'm wondering if that, my diet is good. I'm not overweight. I've never smoked. I drink socially. The change in sodium levels still doesn't seem to be bringing it back to, for example, last summer's levels. So,
yeah.
How much longer should I continue monitoring this before I go back to the doctor and say, I need something?
Yeah, I think monitoring it once or twice a week is a good thing. So I applaud you for doing that. Pressures will run a little bit higher in the morning. So I usually just tell folks, it doesn't matter when you take it, just try to be consistent. If you're consistently, Joe, running above, say, 140 on the systolic, the top number, greater than 90 on the bottom number, then I would think that would be the time to just go and get a few things checked as a matter of routine. Focusing on your sodium, obviously a good idea. A little meditation, and there are no shortages of sort of tools and things out there that people can use may help affect any underlying fight-flight biology that could be contributing to this. A lot of plant-based foods have higher amounts of potassium and magnesium. And those can have very nice sort of natural balancing effects on blood pressure. So those are some things to try.
Hey, Joe, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years' experience. Eye exams by appointment. 518-459-2638. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York, providing educational and residential programs, diagnosis, and treatments for children and adults. AndersonCenterForAutism.org. Boyden and Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenandPerron.com. And Hudson Valley Bounty, an initiative of the Hudson Valley Agribusiness Development Corporation, promoting Hudson Valley farms, wineries, restaurants, and more. HudsonValleyBounty.com.
And we are back. Don't try to get in right now, folks, because all five phones are ringing off the hook. But first, our wonderful producer, Patrick Donges, is here with a little bit of the social media.
Well, because all five phones you mentioned are ringing off the hook,
yes.
You can also post your comments at the and questions at the bottom of today's show page on WAMC.org/VoxPop. You can comment on our wall post at our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC radio, or tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. So this is from Lisa on Facebook. Doctor, a relative has a total cholesterol of 106 after being on a statin for several years. He has a history of obesity and had a stent placed a few years ago after experiencing a blockage. He has lost some weight and believes that at the age of 66, he's now effectively erased the damage of a lifetime of unhealthy living. Are his arteries as clear as he claims with this very low cholesterol number?
That is a very good question, Lisa, and it would be impossible to know just from a very significant drop in cholesterol whether the coronary arteries are, in fact, clear. Certainly bodes well in terms of reducing risk for a second heart attack. Generally, the target for LDL after a person has had a stent, the LDL cholesterol is 70 or less. But we know that even when people get to those low levels, we don't know your family member's LDL, but I suspect if their total cholesterol is 106, their LDL will be less than 70. But there is risk independent of LDL. We talk about HDL, we talk about triglycerides, and they tend to be impacted much more by lifestyle behavior, particularly refined carbohydrates, starches, processed foods. So might there be capacity to moderate the statin dose based on what that LDL is? Certainly. And that would be a discussion to have with the cardiologist caring for him. But I can tell you that there'd be great reluctance to come off a statin after an angioplasty, even with significant lifestyle and behavioral changes, which I applaud. So probably room to moderate that. And it sounds like he's doing a great job of making a lot of very meaningful lifestyle changes.
Great. Thanks, Doc.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay. And we'll go now to Gail in Albany, New York. Okay, Gail, go.
Hi, Dr. Pettis.
Hi, Gail.
My question is, what is your latest thinking on wheat and inflammation, particularly as it relates to our use of genetically modified flour that we buy in the supermarket versus buying more primitive like einkorn?
Yeah, that is a really great question, Gail, and it sort of gets back to Alan's initial question off top. You know, what is hot these days? And the wheat gluten story continues to raise a lot of questions. I think there's no question that a lot of people are either sensitive to not just wheat, but any gluten-containing grain, which would include possibly contaminated oats, rye, barley, that sensitivity, that allergy may not manifest other than low-level inflammation and symptoms such as some intermittent pain and sluggishness, brain fog, fatigue. celiac being an extreme example of a gluten problem where you actually have an autoimmunity, and it can be much more serious in terms of not just gastrointestinal, but also other symptoms throughout the body. I think that while I wouldn't be a proponent of all people eliminating wheat or gluten, I think for many, particularly those who are confronting inflammatory problems, so they have an autoimmune disease or they've had heart disease or they have lots of symptoms that otherwise are not well explained, like pain and fatigue, trouble sleeping, maybe depression, I think an elimination trial of all gluten, including wheat, rye, and barley, could be very, very provocative and very helpful. Another school of thought that is evolving is one around a paleo approach, and time doesn't allow me to get into too much detail there, but that raises a spectrum of not just gluten-containing grains, but possibly all grains.
Is that because the Paleolithics didn't have any grains?
That's exactly right, Alan. Yeah. So you know, grains really hit the scene about 10,000 years ago, and while that may seem like a long, long time ago, from an evolutionary biologic perspective, that is a blink of an eye.
What were they eating? Dinosaur, or what did they eat?
They were eating tubers and other plant-based foods and vegetables, and the meats that they ate were lean, you know, minimally fatty meats. Yeah. They ate fish and nuts and there are a lot of things that have been introduced into the human diet that I think can provoke inflammation. And I think wheat, and I'd also add dairy to that. Cow's milk, I think, can be a real problem for people.
Yeah, it's true. Gail, thank you. Gail, you still there? Huh? Don't ask me. Okay. Well, let's go to Kathleen in Berkshire County. Okay, Kathleen, go.
Hi, yes, Dr.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi. Would a gallbladder issue cause someone's blood pressure to be higher than normal?
Not usually. I say not usually in that the only connection that I could make would be if you were having an active attack, you know, what we call cholecystitis.
Your blood pressure would go up.
Your blood pressure, just in response to the pain and inflammation of a gallstone causing problems, could certainly affect your blood pressure in the short term until it were reconciled. But ordinarily, there's no known connection between gallbladder health and blood pressure.
All right. Thank you. How about a thyroid, hypothyroidism? Would that have...
Usually hypothyroid, not a problem. Occasionally for people with hyper, an overactive thyroid might cause the blood pressure to go up some. But for a low-acting thyroid, which is what most people have, no. Often it's just the opposite.
All
blood pressure
right.
tends to run a little low.
I was just looking to see why it might have increased, like from a pretty stable 120, 130 over sometimes 60 or 70 to 180.
Yeah, so almost always these can be attributed to some interval change. Again, if you're putting on a few more pounds, carrying a little more around the midsection, not
the opposite.
Not walking, you know, I mean, there are some things that one would look at that might explain that.
Okay.
Kathleen, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
You too. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go to Paul in Schenectady. Hey, Paul, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thanks
Hi,
for
Paul.
Taking my call out.
Sure.
My question is, every night, when I sleep at night, in the middle of the night, I often have my nostrils all blocked up with stuff, and I'm wondering if there's anything in my diet that may be causing that.
Certainly, food allergies or sensitivities could be a common cause of chest sinus congestion, Paul. And again, I think just in general, categorically, dairy and gluten would be the two of the broadest categories. Commonly this time of year, particularly at night, dust can be a real problem for people. And, you know, when you're laying recumbent at night, one does not drain their sinuses quite as well. So dust can be a very common environmental trigger for nasal congestion, particularly on the overnight hours. And sometimes I recommend, depending on how problematic it is, you may want to get, a little HEPA air filter in the bedroom can sometimes make a difference for people.
Okay. It's nothing. It's nothing really to do with diet. Then it's something else, probably.
Well, it could be. And again, dairy and gluten would be the two categories. And one way to test that would be to try an elimination of both. I'd say usually a 3 to 4 week period would be a sufficient trial to see if there's cause and effect there.
I see. Very good. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yep. Okay. Now we got two free phones. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Joe in New Windsor. Okay, Joe, you're on.
Hi.
Hi, hey. Joe.
Okay, I had a couple liver transplants 24 years ago. I've been taking the same meds the whole time, but the problem is those meds, Neoral,
yes,
and Imuran, I guess, are toxic. So they're eating up my kidneys, and I don't really know what to do. I mean, I was transplanted at Mount Sinai, which is an hour and a half away from me, and they basically want me to lower the meds, which I tried about like three times, but it's like the damage is already done. So
yeah,
why risk losing my liver? You know, so
yeah, boy, you're in the proverbial between the rock and a hard place there, Joe.
Yeah.
You know, the Neoral, also known as cyclosporin, has a very long track record in terms of preventing rejection, and people have, like yourself, have been living longer with transplants than ever before. But there's a dark side to the medicine, in that it is toxic to the kidney, and it becomes a matter of weighing, you know, the trade-offs, the lesser of the evils, and generally because people can be dialyzed if their kidneys fail, or get a kidney transplant if their kidneys fail. But dealing with liver failure is so much more lethal that generally the trade-off would be to continue the medicine, try to find the lowest dose that will keep the liver functioning normally, and to try to slow the progression of change in your kidney. It's unfortunately, there's just not a whole lot one can do in terms of that trade-off.
Is there anything else I could do? Because I drink a lot of water.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, general health with respect to not just your kidneys, but for total body health, certainly dietary-wise, I would be trying to avoid refined carbs, these foods that have a high glycemic effect. So flour, a lot of processed foods, you know, a lot of red meat, you know, those are things that I would just moderate just from a general health perspective, and that will allow your kidneys to sort of get as much mileage as they possibly can with the medicines you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Right. You bet.
Let's go to Jim in Balsam Lake. Jim, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Jim.
Hi. Doc, I'd appreciate your thoughts on my daughter. I have a 20-year-old daughter who's a sophomore away in college, and from high school she became a vegetarian, and she moved on to being a vegan, and then in the past 6 months she's trying to become a raw vegan.
Mm.
And she belongs to some group called 30 Bananas, and she's staying home with me. She eats raw bananas.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's any, should there be any concerns, especially living in a dorm where it's really difficult getting good raw food.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's a challenging diet to adhere to while in college. So she obviously is very committed. You know, I've yet to see, Jim, any good data comparing raw to cooked. Some people tolerate cooked a little bit better than raw in terms of digestion. Some of the nutrient content can sometimes be subtly changed when you cook foods that may be better preserved for some raw foods. But to my knowledge, there's no real compelling data comparing raw with cooked vegetables for vegans or for vegetarians. I do think there are a few things worth noting as your daughter's health goes in general, in that B12 deficiency can be a problem for pure vegans, vegetarians, and that animal protein is really the only source of B12. You know, occasionally there might be other deficiencies that one might see, B vitamin deficiencies, but B12 would be the biggie. Vitamin D would be another. Those are easily to check, and there certainly are some easy ways to supplement that. But those would be the main concerns in terms of shortfalls of a vegetarian or vegan diet.
Yes, it's hard because she's an enthusiast now, so it's hard to convince her. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks very much. Okay, here we go to Nancy in Poughkeepsie. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. Hi. I have a question because recently in the past couple of years, I become very hydrated because I don't recognize that I'm thirsty. So I just want to know if there would be a reason for that.
So we have this very sensitive thirst mechanism. Humans are beautifully designed to actively become thirsty at the slightest sign of dehydration. Now, generally, when that mechanism becomes impaired, it's usually because a person has had some neurologic issue, if you will, prior stroke, traumatic injury. There are some medicines that can interfere with the thirst mechanism. Some antidepressants, some mood stabilizers may have subtle effects on one's thirst mechanism. Usually, it's not a serious problem unless you know, somebody doesn't have access to water and may be at risk of becoming dehydrated. I wouldn't be sure otherwise why you're not perceiving thirst. My guess is if you were sufficiently dehydrated, you probably would. You may want to think about any medicines that you're taking and the extent to which that could be contributing. But as long as you're, you know, adequately hydrated, getting a few quarts a day of liquids, it would be there's very little danger in becoming overhydrated unless you have heart failure or, you know, kidney failure, things like that.
Because but I could just get exhausted and sleep for 2 hours, and then when I wake up, it occurs to me that I should drink water. So I was just curious if you had any other insights.
But
it could be medicines. It's only been in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Though, so.
And it can take, for some people, it can take many hours before you notice a thirst mechanism. You know, so it's not anything I'd be too concerned about.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Nancy.
Bye. All right. Let's go to Sonia in Massachusetts. Sonia, you're on. Sonia.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, you talking to me? Hi. How are you?
Good. Sonia, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm a truck driver. And recently, in the last couple of weeks, I've noticed that I've got some numbness in the tips of my fingers. And little sharp pain. And it's mainly in my left hand, but now I'm starting to feel it in my right.
Yeah. And I'm taking a wild guess here, Sonia, but I'm guessing you're not from the Albany area.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
What?
So I'm guessing you're not from the Albany area, based on your accent. So there are a lot of things that can cause numbness in the fingers, but the fact that it's only been going on for a few weeks and the fact that you're a truck driver might make me think about something, you know, what I would call mechanical. Something mechanically is sort of irritating, you know, the nerve that runs from the forearm into the hands. That can be things like carpal tunnel, which is a sort of a tightening in the wrist area that can cause some numbness. It might be how you're resting your arms while you're driving, particularly around the elbows, could cause some tingling or numbness in the fingers. There are other things, you know, vitamin deficiencies, things like that. But I would wonder about a mechanical reason, either how you're resting your arms or just the position of your hands and arms, elbows, wrists, you know, that may be provoking this.
Okay. Well, it started in my middle finger, and then it worked over to my index finger, and now it's affecting my thumb.
Yeah. So if it continues, you certainly should have it checked. And again, I would be focusing on whether there may be some entrapment of the nerve, particularly up around the elbow area.
What kind of doctor would you go to, Mark?
You know, I would start with a primary care provider, you know, it could result in a neurologic evaluation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can rest your arms in a particular way, particularly when you're driving for many, many hours. And much like crossing your legs for a long, long time, you'll get some numbness. So this may be mechanical. It may be a simple matter of having like an elbow pad, something to give you a little more cushioning so you're not entrapping those nerves.
Sonia, okay. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Now, who do I go see for that?
I would start with your primary care doctor, Sonia.
All righty.
Okay.
Well, I thank you for all your advice.
You're welcome.
Very helpful.
Sure.
You have a good day.
Safe driving.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Lynn and Brian and John, hang in there. 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts, ashokancenter.org. Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing 24-hour emergency and critical care for dogs and cats every day of the year, including all holidays. VESHDeerfield.com. And Great Barrington Rudolph Steiner School, presenting the Middle School Student Circus with tumbling, clowning, and fun Sunday, March 10th at 2 p.m. at Simon's Rock. GBRSS.org.
We're back with Patrick Donges, our great producer, who has a little bit of social media for us.
Okay, we've got three questions from, we have two from Facebook and one from WAMC.org. Michael on Facebook asks, do you think olive oil is harmful, doctor?
The short answer is no, Michael. Olive oil in virtually every epidemiologic study, most of which included Mediterranean-style diets, clearly is associated with risk reduction, whether it be heart disease, cancer, stroke. Olive oil contains mostly monounsaturated fats, oleic acid, which are very healthy anti-inflammatory fats. So olive oil is good. Usually I recommend extra virgin.
Okay. Now we have R. Befali on WAMC.org asks, I'm a 50-year-old healthy female. When I get up from a reclining position, such as when I first get out of bed, my feet feel heavy, a little quote-unquote draggy, and somewhat pained for the first several steps. The pain disappears within 5 to 10 seconds. I'm too embarrassed to raise this question with my doctor until I have some idea of what this could be. Any ideas?
If it's something that you're noticing when you first get up, it's possible it could be either a little circulatory or almost sciatic-like, positional problem that, works its way out. It sounds like it does get better, once you start moving around. Sometimes people can get a little bit of swelling, but generally that's worse toward the end of the day than first thing in the morning. So it may be a bit of a mechanical issue. Sort of nerve root, nothing serious, or a bit of a circulatory problem, which can make the legs feel a bit heavy and once you start moving around. And again, that's not anything that would concern me either. It's just more of a mechanical problem, perhaps how you're sleeping.
Okay. And now last one, Elaine on Facebook asks, Doctor, could you speak about artificial sweeteners versus sugar?
Boy, that's a really great question, Elaine, and one I could spend a lot of time on. So I'm just going to give you the Cliff Note version. While artificial sweeteners have appeal from the perspective that they're calorie free, and people who are trying to reduce calories are often served well by switching to sweeteners, there's a lot of really provocative data with artificial sweeteners suggesting that the sweetness, and most artificial sweeteners are as much as 200 times sweeter than actual table sugar, may actually cause sort of biologic changes once you ingest them that can create insulin surges, which are not healthy, can stimulate appetite because the brain is anticipating all this load of sweet calories, which is not forthcoming. People and animals, when you put them on sweeteners, often consume more calories throughout the day, which is really interesting. So I generally don't recommend artificial sweeteners. And I would say even a teaspoon of regular sugar in your coffee in the morning, if that's the only source of sugar you're getting, is probably better than an artificial sweetener.
Thank you, Patrick. It's always wonderful to have
you
here. Thank you very much. Okay, and now we're going to go to Lynn in Ware, Massachusetts. Mm. Lynn, you're on.
Hi. How are you? My question is about kidney stones and whether having chronic kidney stones has implications for the health of kidney functioning.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. Kidney stones can, over time, cause damage or breakdown of kidney function. Usually, it is on the basis of certain types of stones that we call staghorn calculi. These are very large stones that essentially obstruct the kidney. So over time, they can damage the kidneys. And these are stones usually associated with recurrent urinary tract infection. Other stones, while they can impact kidney function, tend to do so very, very infrequently. And when they do, it's usually because they've been obstructing the kidney. And if the kidneys are obstructed too long, they will have some irreversible damage. But for the most part, you don't typically see kidney damage with kidney stones.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We've got a Brian in Southfield. Brian, you're on. Hey, Brian, you're on.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Brian.
I'm 65 years old, and 2 years ago, I had a radical prostatectomy. And I have two questions related to that. One, does the removal of the prostate affect hormone production because it's totally destroyed my sex life? And the second one is, I seem to have lost a secondary control on my urinary function, and I was wondering if there's something I can do to stop leakage.
Yeah. So the two most common complications of a radical prostatectomy are erectile dysfunction and urinary incontinence. So you describe... I don't know if the sexual issue is erectile dysfunction. There can be many other types
yes.
of, but those are usually caused by some nerve damage, which is unfortunately very well described and not at all uncommon after a radical prostatectomy. Usually, one doesn't see changes in hormone production. The prostate gland doesn't produce much in the way of hormone. So I wouldn't expect any connection there with, for example, testosterone. However, many men your age might have a low testosterone level, which has nothing to do with your prostate, but could also be a cause of libido. Usually it's more of a libido issue than an erectile dysfunction issue. So I don't know that there's anything that could be done to reconcile either of those problems. But I might think about having a testosterone level drawn in your blood. And again, if there were libido issues, it might help with that. It could, but less likely help with erectile dysfunction.
Mark, what is the libido concept here? I'm a little confused.
So the libido concept is one of a desire.
So you lose desire because you've had the operation?
No. I think this is totally unrelated to the operation.
I see.
I was just trying to connect the hormone, which isn't connected to the prostate surgery, but sometimes there are other causes of erectile dysfunction or sexual dysfunction, low testosterone being one that
impacts. Well, I seem to have lost all the urge after the prostatectomy.
Yes. And again, it's hard.
That could be psychological then.
Well, it's possible. I mean, certainly having erectile dysfunction is going to affect one's libido. But the only reason I even bring up testosterone is you had alluded to hormones, and that can sometimes be an independent, separate, treatable factor that for some men can help with libido and sexual dysfunction. I would not expect that to have any impact on incontinence, urinary incontinence.
Brian, good questions. We thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you very
much, Brian.
Guys.
Let's go to John in Colony. John in Colony, you're on.
Hi. This is a great show. You touched on the Mediterranean diet and how it's beneficial, etc. But I've always been a firm believer that stress brings on disease.
Yes.
And I'm curious to know, in incorporating a Mediterranean diet, what percentage do you put on their lifestyle and the way they respond to things, and how we as an American culture, our stress levels are a whole lot higher, one would assume.
Yeah, that's a really great question, John. I never look at nutrition or diet in isolation. It's always part of a more global look at one's lifestyle and behavior. And, you know, if you were to take the top three lifestyle contributors to all chronic complex diseases like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, the big three would be the foods that we eat. We simply do not consume. The American diet is just not compatible with what we are designed to be ingesting. The second would be how we interpret and respond to stress, which really gets to your question. So people who struggle in their capacity to effectively interpret and respond to stressful events in their lives, of which there are many in any person's lives, will further compound any quality of life and health issue. And then movement would certainly be the other. You know, if we all turn the clock back and we could take a glimpse at our Stone Age ancestors who wandered the African savanna, and you and I both had ancestors that did so, you'd see them moving a lot. You would see them basically resting, enjoying community. We've lost touch with a lot of that, and I think stress is a major contributor to most health problems. So, you know, fixing diet without addressing stress would only partially address one's self-care.
So if you were in Crete, you might have a better lifestyle than if you were in New York.
Yeah, it's a great point, Alan. And a good book for the listeners, The Blue Zones by Daniel Buettner. Buettner's a writer for National Geographic. The Blue Zones are these parts of the world where people live extraordinarily long lives, like Okinawa, Japan, like Nicoya, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, excuse me. They eat unprocessed foods, they move a lot, and they celebrate community. A lot of very rich, meaningful social connection there. So they're critical factors.
Hey, John, thanks for bringing us here. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, John.
We'll go to Marie in Schenectady. Marie in Schenectady, you're on.
Hi. Kudos again to you, Dr. Shartok, for having Dr. Pettit on. Been listening for at least 5 or more years. I'm glad he's closer to the Capital District. But what I will say, I'm the lady with the MCD. I found out what caused it doing research on my own. I'm educated, but let's leave it at that. I know most of the nephrologists in the area leave the hospital unnamed. What you just said is the biggest thing, most direct thing, which could help kidney patients, whatever the progression of the disease. I was on prednisone. It did work. However, what caused the allergic reaction was an anesthetic applied to my wrist. And edema and all the rest of it. What I will say is you deserve the laureate. I don't know whether I want to. You know what I'm trying to say again. Everything you're expressing is what the patients do not get. Finally, your associate over at the other hospital, they finally got a nutritionist. I knew all this stuff. Mediterranean diet, when I heard the news on CBS, I said, geez, I've been doing that for 5 years. The meat, you got to watch. The fish, what the hell? What can we eat if the food and drug can't inspect it? But I will leave it at, I love you. We love you for what you're expressing. Just, you're so upfront. You know,
you're right. Hey, Marie, you're right, and we got to let you go because you're absolutely right. But I want to get everybody in, okay?
Alan, thank you,
okay,
and Dr. Pettit, thank you too.
Okay. Thanks for making my day, Marie.
Yeah, that was great. okay, let's go to Joseph in Po-town, Poughkeepsie. Joseph, you're on. Joseph. Oh no, I see what happened here. Joseph, are you on? Are you there, Joseph?
Yes,
okay, go ahead.
I'm still here. I'm a vegetarian, and I've been a vegetarian for about 18 years and a vegan for about 12. I was listening to the gentleman I called about his daughter, the doctor was right on. Now, the thing with B12, I learned that if you have a clean colon, you will produce B12. And if you eat breakfast in the morning before you brush your teeth, that would help you with your B12 as well, because we're animals. We can't produce our own if our bodies are functioning properly. And you got to eat a really good balanced diet.
Yeah. Okay, stop right there, because I'm trying to get us all done here. Mark, you want to respond
to
this?
Yeah, no, really good point, Joseph. I agree with you totally. The body does have to be in good health in order to absorb B12 and manage it properly.
Okay, thanks a lot, Joseph. The thing I don't understand is when he said you should brush your teeth before you brush your teeth. What does that mean?
I'm not sure I understand the implication of that suggestion.
All right, good. All right, okay. Let's go to Lima in Sullivan County. Lima or Lima?
Yeah, it's Lima like Lima Bean.
Lima.
Okay.
You got to hurry. Go ahead.
All right. You mentioned the book Blue Stones. Can you please tell me the author? I missed it.
Yeah, so the title, Lima, is Blue Zones.
Z-O-N-E-S. Right.
It's a great read. The author is Daniel, last name Buettner, and I believe that is spelled B-U-E-T-T-N-E-R.
Wonderful.
Daniel Buettner. Highly recommend it. Some excellent wisdom there.
And putting his
his
major thesis in one line, Mark, it would be?
Live like our paleo ancestors once lived, and we can probably navigate modern life with much less disease, much more happiness.
Exactly. And you also mentioned sugar.
Yes.
Sweeteners.
Yes.
If you can inject somewhere along the line what your opinion is on aspartame, which is under a heading of invert sugar, I understand it's quite dangerous.
Okay, go ahead, Mark.
Thank you, honey. It's a great show.
Yeah, thank you. So,
all right, bye-bye.
Take care. So again, the artificial sweeteners, with maybe the exception of stevia, which is more of a plant-based, I would generally shy away from. And there are many different types, aspartame being one such type.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And we're out of time here, but I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to everybody who wanted to call in but didn't get a chance to. I'd also like to thank Dr. Mark Pettis, our great friend, for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Eric Krupke. Our producer is Patrick Donges. You heard from him today as he came in with the social media. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update. And while I have a moment, just remember, there are still a few seats left to hear Governor Patrick and Diane Patrick at the Colonial Theater on Sunday at 12:30. Give us a call, 1-800-323-9262. It's going to be a fabulous time. Don't be shut out. Here we go.